It's a wonder I can think at all. Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Miriam Gershow, author of the new novel Closer from Regal House Publishing. Miriam's books include the novel The Local News and the story collection Survival Tips, which was a finalist for the 2025 Oregon Book Award in Fiction, an Independent Publisher Book Award Silver Medalist, and winner of the PenCraft Award's Best Book for Short Stories. Her fiction has appeared in the Georgia Review, Gulf Coast, and Black Warrior Review, among other journals, and she's published her flash fiction and creative nonfiction in numerous journals and anthologies. Miriam currently teaches at the University of Oregon. The writer David Bradley says this about Closer: "This novel is amazing. In powerful prose vignettes that read like poems, Gershow rounds up the usual suspects: race, gender, generation, religion, income, disability, sexuality, but gives voice and perspective to characters who insist on being human, often maddeningly so." Please join us for our conversation with Miriam Gershow, which is already in progress. Miriam, welcome back, and thanks. You're looking good after a week or so with pneumonia. Huh?
Thank you so much for having me. I've been sleeping a lot.
But you said the medicine's working, but the steroids have kind of a magical effect.
They do. They make you want to do some jumping jacks.
Right, or lift 300-pound weights or something. You could enter the Olympics at this point. Well, when we talked for your story collection Survival Tips, and that was last year, you mentioned initially trying to get the book published but didn't sell. It was a tough market for short fiction, even a collection, I should add, that became a finalist for the Oregon Book Awards in Fiction. Your agent suggested you try a novel, and that book, The Local News, took only 6 days to sell. Pretty amazing. And now 15 years later, you're back with the new novel, Closer. Though published a year after Survival Tips, I read that you actually finished Closer first, the manuscript?
I did. I finished Closer. Closer, I started in 2018 and spent a couple years writing it. It didn't sell initially when I tried to sell it. And it was one of those books that I, I'm okay with letting go of books if they don't sell. I think the nature of writing, unless you're Stephen King, is that some of the books you write don't sell. But this one, I just knew this was the book I wanted to keep trying. I wanted to keep looking for a home for it. So I ended up, I had an amicable breakup with my agent when she was done selling it. And I was like, no, we need to keep going with this. And I put it away for a while. I revised it again. I kind of did everything I could to make a sale happen. And eventually I was the one that sent it out to Regal House, which is where it ended up. And they've done a really beautiful job with it. But that, I sold it 7 years after I'd written it.
You published your first novel. You mentioned Regal House. You published the first novel, Local News, with Random House. So it's a big five publisher. But that soured you a bit on the big commercial presses?
I mean, it feels like the world's smallest violin to say I'm soured on the big five. Like, the big five are an incredible, incredible experience. It was, I had a New York Times review. I had on publication day, the book was on the front table of every Barnes and Noble in the country. Like, there's a distribution and marketing with Big Five that you just aren't going to get with anyone else. So I feel really, really grateful for that. But everyone warned me that if I, this, literary fiction writer from Eugene, Oregon, had a Big Five book, it might get lost in the shuffle. And It did get lost in the shuffle to an extent. So I felt like both the pros and the cons of the Big Five experience were really clear to me. I felt very, very lucky that that's what happened with my first book, but I didn't need it again because I saw those pros and cons so clearly. I think because it took so long to sell my second book, I got really clear on the fact that I just wanted to find publishers who loved the work and supported me as an author. And I let go of visions of it needs to be another Big Five book.
And that was a better experience. Of course, Survival Tips with Propeller Books and Regal House for Closer, where you're getting a lot more attention and certainly care from the publisher.
I feel like I had an amazing editor at Spiegel and Grau, who was the Random House imprint, and I've ended up with really amazing editors at Propeller. I mean, Propeller is a one-man show with Dan DeWeese in Portland, and
Yeah, he does a great job.
he's amazing. He's totally brilliant. I loved having a publisher just up the road, and Regal House is this small women-run publisher out of North Carolina who makes beautiful books. So, all three have been really wonderful in their own ways. In some ways, you can't even compare it because, no one's a beast like Random House. Random House can get the word out, can get your book out. There's no replicating that. If there's no replicating that experience, but all three have been really incredible in their own ways. And I don't need a big book. That I think is what I the writing is what matters to me. I don't need a big book per se. I want to be able to be writing, and I want publishers to be interested in publishing my work.
Now, you were writing Closer at about the same time you were writing the stories in Survival Tips. And actually, you wrote some of the stories in Survival Tips before that. But this was a question we talked a little bit about last year. How do you decide whether an idea is best for one or the other form? And I was trying to imagine Closer as a short story, short fiction, and I couldn't.
Yes. I mean, I think that's the answer, that I never know where I am going when I start, whether it's flash fiction, short story, novel, but the story tends to lead itself. Like the story tends to either get itself where it needs to go or not. Like I have a lot of things that end up in the recycle bin, but the story tends to know. So if I'm paying attention and following it, it will define the form. Although, let me think about it. I think at this point, I have an intuition about if something is a short story. I think I can write myself towards a shorter work, towards like a short fiction or a flash. I have a sense of if it will be right sized for that. I think it's the novel piece that I don't know. That is usually like I can only see a few steps ahead of me. I can't see beyond that. And so if I have the momentum for it to keep going and keep going and keep going, that turns into a novel.
Now, Closer starts with an incident of racism at West High School, which is this fictional high school in the fictional town of Horace, Oregon, somewhat based on your hometown of Eugene. I thought this was inspired by an actual event. Maybe in a Eugene high school, but at your Broadway books launch, you said that wasn't the case.
That is correct. I like that it feels like it could be real because
Definitely.
that's what I always aspire to in my fiction. But no, I mean, I would imagine that incidents of white kids being knuckleheads and taunting black students happen regularly, but it's not based on a specific incident.
Now, you've called the book a quintessential Eugene novel. This is this fictional town, Horace, kind of a stand-in for Eugene. And Eugene is a predominantly white and liberal college town, a big college town, University of Oregon. So it's interesting to explore this high school racial incident through the characters in a community like that. I mean, it's not like it happened in the Deep South or Midwest.
Right. Yeah. I am from Detroit. My husband's from Cleveland. So it's always an interesting experience raising a kid in Eugene, Oregon, where it feels like, hey, this isn't this isn't what the world looks like. This is not the racial makeup of the world. We're kind of in pretend land here. But what was interesting to me, I mean, that's what made it interesting to me, that it is a town, like that the white people in the town see themselves as liberal, as benign, as good. There's not the same, like, explicit racial lines or racial tensions in other places in the country. There's not the same sort of segregation, but there's still the same kind of roiling underbelly as there is anywhere.
Now, the events in the book take place over the course of a school year from winter semester 2015 to summer 2016. Obama is still president in the book, and you call it this time period the not so distant past. I just call it the good old days. Now, why did you pick this time period, this not so distant past?
I think part of it is that I started the book not so long after that time period, and I started writing it in the early days of Trump 1.0, when suddenly I felt like my fictional lens had to expand to include the political reality of the United States. Because I feel like I was like a lot of white middle class ladies, in that, if I were listening to the black and brown people around me, they were saying, it's always been like this. You're just growing aware of it for the first time. Like, this cycle and institutions of racism being the engine of our country, this is how it's always been. Like, it's now affecting you. And I really heard that and took that to heart, and it informed my activism, and it informed my politics, and I felt like it necessarily had to inform my writing. So I ended up just setting this on that cusp, the golden
Yes,
escalator that
before the
Trump
deluge.
comes. Yeah, before the deluge, when it seems like, is this going to be real? Is this really where we're heading? With knowing all along for the reader that in fact it is where we're heading.
Now, in the initial synopsis for Survival Tips, the story collection, you wrote that the stories were about failures in love, and it was somewhat of a connecting theme. We see that theme also in Closer, along with a few successes in love. But in a recent article in Eugene Weekly, you said you don't usually think about themes in your work. You're most interested in the bad decisions that people make.
Yeah, I am. I was thinking, oh, what's Ken going to think about these characters? Because when we went through survival tips, you're like, and here was another poor decision. And here was another poor decision.
Yes, I re-listened, and there was a lot of that. I also mentioned that, and we could talk a little about this maybe a little later, was some of the characters are miserable and they act out in terms of trying to make others miserable too. And that connected a few of the stories,
Yeah, and
which is a
so
poor decision.
it is a poor decision. I think the with Closer, I was interested in both the bad decisions people make, and then I think this is a sign of my growth. And then what, there's a tragedy on page, you find out about the tragedy on page two of the book, so it's not really a spoiler, but when this tragic event happens, how does it get people to change their perspective or their positionality, or what moves them toward genuinely trying to get closer to who they need to get closer to? That really interested me. So not only what are the mistakes that people make, but how do people kind of make up for their bad acts? Not quite in terms of atonement, because that's not really what this story is about, but how do they essentially, how do they do better? How do they, if they've acted really poorly, which I think many of us do a lot of the time, how does essentially a tragedy give them a reset?
And as you said, they're attempting to get closer, so kind of come together, form some kind of community, even a real small ones. In fact, I've talked about this for a previous book. There's a book by Rebecca Solnit, where she talks about big tragedies. So a lot of them climate related or school shootings, things like that. And one of the silver linings is the way people come together afterwards, which she focused on in at least that section of the book. And I think that's somewhat how you're operating here.
I think that's right. To me, the human condition is we're all just sort of going along, trying to make it through our days. The larger implications of each of the choices we're making aren't necessarily clear to us. So, I mean, I say it's not a book about atonement because there's no one person who's responsible for the tragedy in the book, but everyone has their own little piece and part to play in it. And so, even understanding that you're a part of a community and responsible to a community is part of what was interesting to me about writing these characters in this story.
And I want to talk a little bit about the characters. As we mentioned, the novel centers on this Oregon high school, fictional West High, and the characters are students, staff, and their families. When we talk for survival tips, you said, "I have been long obsessed with high school." Your first novel, The Local News, was narrated by a 15-year-old high school student, and there are a few stories and survival tips with the same setting. Given your penchant for characters who make bad decisions, this is kind of the mother load.
It is the mother lode. I was really, really one of the books that really inspired this was Tom Perata's Election, which is so different in tone and scope and content.
Yeah, a little more satirical.
So, a little more satirical, a bite-sized book. But what I really liked is the way that both the adults and the kids in high school are implicated in the plot and the story there. And that really interested me here because I think one of my obsessions is one of the reasons that high school is such an obsession is that we're like all just a bunch of big galoots that are still our high school selves. So
I have a friend just like that. It's kind of sad in a way. He's a little too much like his high school self,
I mean,
but
it is sad in a way. As much as I'm obsessed with it in my writing, I refuse to go to a high school reunion, so I don't consider myself someone who's like fixated on high school in that way. But I think that we're all like our insecure, wavy, half-formed selves that we were. Like, so there's a kernel of that in all of us.
Now, you mentioned Tom Perata, but you wrote this article for LitHub, six high school novels for adult readers. One of the ones you mentioned was Zoe Heller's "What Was She Thinking? Notes on a Scandal," and you say pretty much that Heller writes one of your favorite kinds of high school novels: adults behaving badly, because
Yes.
I guess they're behaving like they're high school students
Yes.
again.
Exactly. And that book is so, does one of my favorite sneaky things in that you think you're reading about Barbara Covett is telling the story of another teacher who's having an affair with a student, and you think you're reading about Sheba Hart's affair. Like you think that's what the book is about, and then slowly it dawns on you, oh no, this is Covett's story. Her
Yes,
longing
the
and loneliness. And so, high school or not, I love a sneaky first person narrator who, oh, look, you think the story is one thing, but it's really about them and their bad acts.
and in that same article, six high school novels for adult readers, you wrote, "The crowded, sweaty hallways of our youth, as I see it, do not belong only to YA books. I'm old enough to have a kid finishing his freshman year. And I've come to embrace the part of me that remains preoccupied creatively and psychically with high school. The person I was then, awkward, gangly, too loud by half, desperate to be something, feels like a shadow self, still there at my core, even if papered over by 30 plus years of striving, heartbreak, mortgages, successes, medications, homes, therapists, missteps, community, and family." I found that a pretty good entry to the new novel, where you feature characters on both sides of that spectrum, the high school students and then the adult high school students.
Yes, and I think for better or worse, I don't see some dividing line between like, oh, teenagers don't know how to act yet, but adults clearly do. And adults have the like, the moral and ethical values to guide them to shape up and live right. Like that isn't the human experience to me. It's like we're all making the same different versions of the same mistakes as we go along, which I love. I mean, that's what makes characters interesting to me to both read and write.
Oh, yes, if people learned, everything and improved their behavior, there'd be no fiction, would there? It'd be kind of
Exactly.
boring to read. Oh,
Exactly.
look, they were kind of a hellcat as a kid, but now they're perfect.
Right.
Now, Closer's dedicated to your son Eli, a high school student. Did Eli and his friends inspire some of the insights into the minds of the book's high school students? And did you consult with him at all, show him some sections? And Eli, did I get this right?
That's such a good question. I think because I started it when he was 8 years old, I
Ah!
didn't consult him on it, but it's been so, one of the characters is this mother, Stephanie, who has this fierce protection of her son and really struggles to let go for the whole book for both of her sons. And it was very interesting to spend the lead up to Eli's teen years writing this book, because I am sort of a distracted mother, always with things to do because I'm busy writing books. I'm also this stereotypical Jewish mother who would like to smother my son in all the attention and love and care and guidance. So it's been interesting watching myself like grow into something like Stephanie's character, where I really need to watch it so I don't smother my son in protectiveness and let him fly free, do what he needs to do as a teenager. But she, as a character, has resonated more and more with me as I've grown into writing the book.
And I wonder if this resonates with you also, Miriam. You have a great line in the book, and this is given to Woody, who's the West High School guidance counselor. And he calls parenthood, quote, a straight dive into one's own humiliation. Is that something you discovered as a parent, as a mom?
I do definitely think that yes, that especially as the parent of a teen, like nobody will snuggle up to you and tell you that you have more wrinkles than Donald Trump, like your own teenager will. It's a lesson in humility all the time.
Now, at the very start of the book, so this takes place about a year after the events of the book begin, and you already mentioned, you alluded to it on page two, we learn a student at West High, Olivia Albrecht, who's called Livy, killed herself. And we learn this from Woody, the guidance counselor. He's talking to Livy's friend Lark, another student at the school, again a year after the events begin. Why the big reveal so early in the story?
That's such a good question. I've asked myself this question. It's one of those things of that's how it came out. That was sort of Tom Spombauer was a longtime teacher of mine in the 1990s, and he always said, you set up your horses at the beginning of the book, and the horses are what carries the story across. And that ended up being that was one of the earliest pieces that I wrote. And that ended up being one of the engines that then took the book across. We go back a year in time, but that tension of how did Libby die? What were the circumstances of her death?
Right. It turns it into this mystery, and you got to keep reading at that point.
You're right. And so,
Why did she kill herself?
right, I toyed with taking it out from the beginning because I think the book is about a lot more than that. Like, I don't think that's only what the book is about, but I went back and forth with that several times of like, do I need this on page two? And I ended up keeping it.
Now, the book is structured into sections with three main narrators. each told in the third person, but from that character's point of view. So that's sometimes called close third person. This allows us to get an inside look at them as they interact with the other characters. Why did you choose this way to tell the story rather than, say, first person or more of a formal third person narrative, not close?
Yeah. One, I felt like with one thing after I wrote the no local news years and years ago, which is my first novel, and it was first person, and I'd written a lot of first person, I became kind of intrigued by third person because you weren't limited to what the character knew. You know, with the first person narrator, the only things that can be narrated are what that character knows about themselves or is willing to say out loud. So I became kind of enchanted with third person narrators. There's a switch in my short stories too, where I start writing a lot more in third person. And I think for this, like with so many of my longer works, it's like these three voices came to me. Woody came first with the news that Libby had died. Then Stephanie, the mom character, came to me, and Lark, Libby's best friend, came to me. And the voices were so distinct to me that I just followed them. I think I had no idea what a challenge I was setting up for myself because I followed them, and then had to figure out, like, oh, how do I bring these together with this tragedy that I set up on page two? And I didn't really know how to at that point. I had to figure it out. But with so much, especially in a longer work, it's like the voices of the characters are what carry me through the writing. And this time it just happened to be these three. And there were a lot more that had one-off chapters.
Oh, yes, yeah, Stephanie's husband, Derek, and Lark's girlfriend, Monique, at least two of them. I was wondering also why you had those sections in those to tell more of the story, because you needed to tell it from a different character's point of view.
Derek came after a reader gave me feedback when they read an early draft that they were interested in Derek's perspective. But the other one-off chapters in Naomi, Stephanie's child, older son, Nathan's caregiver, she gets a chapter. Is it valid to say because it was fun? Like those were perspectives that I was really interested in. I think Naomi is a key character in the story, and that there's this incident of violence between her and Nathan, and I wanted to render that really sensitively and not further any stereotypes that like an autistic adult is going to be violent. So I felt like that I wanted Naomi to have her own chapter so you could see that situation with a little bit more nuance. But it's also, again, like the freedom of third person is you can inject all of this information that it's not necessarily the character who's giving it to you, but the author and the narrator can. And I really like that freedom. So I liked it with bringing in those one-off chapters. And also in every book, I have the character that I'm like, oh, that's not a real character. And Monique was that in this book. So I really loved writing her chapter.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. On today's show, we're talking with Miriam Gershow, author of the new novel Closer from Regal House Publishing. Now, one of the main characters, which we talked about with her own sections, is Stephanie. She's the mother of Livy's boyfriend. Livy's the girl who commits suicide on page two. Boyfriend Baz. Stephanie is black, married to a white husband, Derek. How'd you get into the head of a black character, deciding on the voice, the inner life? I know that can be a perilous strategy for a writer now, among other writers, readers, and especially literary critics.
For sure. By the way, Derek's black. Did you say white?
Oh, I thought Derek was white.
No, Derek's black.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's so interesting, Ken.
Wow. No, it didn't strike me. I thought Stephanie was black and Derek was white.
Oh, that's so fascinating. No, they're all black.
Wow. And I thought I did a close reading, but I guess I missed that.
Well, you know what they say, like the book is the reader's once it's out in the world. So there's your interpretation. You could write a paper on how your interpretation of Derek being white.
Yeah, and how wrong I was. Oh, I'm sorry, Miriam, I didn't get that. But
No, that's
still,
okay.
I want to get back to getting Stephanie's voice,
Yeah.
who you and I both knew were black. You're from, you wrote her that way, and I read her that way.
I did. Okay, so I think the first step was, like I said, the character's voice came to me and staying open to that and following it. And then it wasn't until I finished the first draft that I was like, holy crap, one of my point of view narrators is this black woman. What is my responsibility now? And I think had I not finished the first draft, I don't know that I would have finished if I'd had those considerations earlier. I don't know if I would have finished the story, but it really became for years the focus of my revision energy. So I did several things. I read as much as I could by black female authors. My coworker Courtney Thorson, who was also nominated for an Oregon Book Award last year, she teaches African American lit, and her whole life is getting people to read more black women authors. And so she sent me off with a reading list just to get the voice, get the perspective, just to fill myself with enough knowledge as possible. So I could be making an authentic go of this. And then I also gave the book to readers, to black readers, and said, what did I get right? What did I get wrong? And so, I wasn't thinking of it. People talk about sensitivity readers, and that's what I was essentially doing, but it was just people I knew, and they gave me really valuable feedback, and I integrated it. And it was definitely the character I spent the most time making sure that I got right out of all the characters in the book. And I think that's the only way it could be, because I have an extra responsibility as a white writer to make sure that I'm getting this other person's perspective. Alexander Chee and others say, do not, if you are in a dominant group, do not write a non-dominant group character unless you must because of the story. And I didn't know how to tell this story without Stephanie. So it was worth it to me to figure out how to get it right, which I hope I have.
Oh, I think so. And you really, there's no stereotypes in there with Stephanie. She's her own person. But I think you also mentioned this at the Broadway Books launch. A good friend of yours, as you call her in the acknowledgments, the late great Kai Emmons. You said she encouraged you, but cautioned you don't want to write an angry black woman.
Yes. She in the first she and Deborah Gortney made up my longtime writing group. Deborah Gortney's still my most trusted reader. The very first draft. So Stephanie is this mom of a teenager who's convinced that Livy is not the right fit for her son. This is their first love. This is Boz's first relationship, and she just kind of gets it in her craw that this girl is not good for him. And in the very first draft, I don't know how motivated that was. So she sort of came across as stubborn and obstinate in some ways. So that was both Kai and Deborah's caution. Don't put a black character in the middle of the narrative and then make her. She wasn't the villain, but don't make her the antagonist to the story. And I really, really took that to heart. And it took years and a number of revisions to give her the plot that would fill out, that would make her attitude legitimate, that she's just overwhelmed by this appearance of this girl, distrustful, and builds up, this opposition that isn't always grounded in reality. But yeah, it gets stuck in her craw that this girl is not good for her son.
Well, I think one touch that helps quite a bit, you make her part of this, what's called now the sandwich generation, which is universal. It's not just a black or a white thing or any ethnic group. She's caring for her children, including Nathan, who's developmentally disabled, while her mom in Chicago has dementia And she faces a similar choice in each case, whether to send Nathan to a foster home instead of living at home, and she and Derek and Baz are caring for him, and her mom to assisted living, both less than ideal prospects given the conditions of some of these places.
Exactly. And this is like a nod to my dad, who spent his last 3.5 years up in assisted living in Eugene. And my whole next book is set in an assisted living facility. But that Sam, the impossibility of caring for someone when we are not set up to care for people at home really is a lasting experience of helping my dad through his final years. And, I kept, fairly or not, just piling up pressures on Stephanie so that it would, so that her motivations would line up. She doesn't have room for one more thing. And that's what
No,
Libby is one more thing.
that's a full plate. Yeah, my dad also spent his last years in assisted care and then moved across the street to long-term care.
Oh, yeah.
And it was good for him, especially his social life. But there's aspects of that that, if I'm in the same situation, I do not look forward to.
Exactly. It's really hard to find a good, holistic, sustainable situation.
Yeah, there's always complaints, mainly about food, you know.
Yes.
Jews. Another of the main characters is Woody, as we mentioned, the high school guidance counselor. He serves as kind of a bridge between the book's adults and the high school students. He tries to do the right thing. He seems like a good guy at heart, but he's also prone to bad decisions. You've said, Miriam, you like his foibles and you love the character.
I do love the character. People have really strong feelings about Woody. Woody has sort of like the most unforced errors of any of. I mean, he just sort of goes headlong into bad decisions. But like all of us, I think he sees himself as the hero of his own story. Like he just sees himself kind of stumbling into these opportunities and is doing the best he can. And so I found all of his choices to be really like grounded in his reality and motivated. Like they were, I don't know. You said it. I love him. I don't think he makes the best decisions, but that I think neither do I.
No, you could see he's a guy that's kind of living in obscurity. And then all of a sudden, with Livy's suicide and the racial incident, he's the center of attention at high school. Or again, he's that fulcrum between the
Yes.
adults and the kids.
Yes. And I was so interested in what it would mean for someone who's so long used to being on the periphery to suddenly be in the center, like at staff meetings. He's the guy that he's the point person. He's who the vice principal's standing in his doorway in the morning asking him to solve things. All of a sudden, he is the hero of the story. And, that kind of gets out of hand for him.
The third main character, with her own sections from that close third person narrative, is a high school student. She's also Livy's best friend, Lark. At Broadway Books, you said that both Stephanie and Woody make bad choices, but not Lark. But she has her own problems, with a depressed single mom and some confusion about her own sexual orientation. And she gets some satisfaction from seeing, quote, other people trapped in a big, ugly mess, too. That reminded me of, again, several characters in Survival Tips who are miserable and kind of want to make others miserable. She doesn't want to make others miserable, but she doesn't mind when they are, it seems. It's almost comforting.
It's almost comforting, and I think, that moment of Lark feeling that way is the moment of quick violence between Nathan and his caregiver, Naomi. And I think it is not in Lark's nature to feel that way, but I think things have gotten so overwhelming and so out of control, and her whole life has shifted with her best friend Livy in this new relationship, and she doesn't really know what to do with herself, that it's like a surprising moment to realize, oh, look, I feel this she wants to think of herself as a good person and like the nicest of everyone she knows, which in a lot of ways she is, but she has that moment when things are falling apart of like this moment of satisfaction of, oh good, things are falling apart for other people too.
Yeah, you've put all three of the main characters in pressure cookers and seen how they react and the decisions they make.
Exactly.
Now, there's another character in the book, and you talked about him, Nathan. He's the developmentally challenged son of Stephanie, and he's Baz's brother. This is a very detailed and convincing portrait of a young adult with that condition and what it takes to care for him, both at home and then later at the foster home. What was your research like to make sure it was accurate?
Yes, this was like if I put in my effort to make sure that I got Stephanie right as a Black parent, Nathan is the character that I, again, got to the end of the first draft and then thought, oh my God, I have to like really, I have this nonverbal autistic adult character. I need to make sure I'm doing this right. And I, before I began my life as a fiction writer, I worked in mental health advocacy and I reached out to some of the people I knew from that, Claudia Center, who's a disability lawyer in San Francisco, is a good friend of mine. And I said, can you put me in touch with nonverbal autistic adults so I can talk about the depiction of this character? And she did. And I talked to folks who were just able to tell me about their experience, none of whom are the same as Nathan's, but they gave me enough information about how they communicate, limits on their communication, how they fit into their family systems, that I could really fill out Nathan in revisions. And his character was so important to me because I just wanted him to be like a full, fleshed out character, even if he was nonverbal. I wanted him to have his own agency. I wanted him to have his own trajectory. I didn't want him just to be like, oh, look at the inspiring disabled person.
And also the relationships that his family has with him and other people,
Yes.
including his caregivers. I think that helps round him out too.
Yes. Good. That's really good to hear.
Now, one blurb for Closer, and this from the writer Porter Shreve, says what plays out in a public school in Oregon in 2015, racism, harassment, bullying, preventable death, feels like a microcosm of the turmoil that's been tearing apart our national community. Was using West High as that microcosm on your mind at all while writing the book, or that just kind of turned out that way?
I think it kind of turned out that way. And, you know, given how long the process was, I sort of had a delusion that by the time I'd written the book, we'd be out of the Trump era and into a happier, more peaceful coexistence.
Hey,
And it
I
wouldn't
shared your
be.
delusion.
Yes. I wish it were less resonant. But sadly, yeah, so that was not intentional. And I wish the book were not as timely as it is.
Boy, that's probably true with 1984, too,
Yes.
huh? Now, you were asked a great question during the Broadway Books event. Closer is not considered a young adult or YA novel. What distinguishes a YA book from one for more adult audiences?
Yeah, I think there's two things, or at least in my head, this is, well, there's probably three things. One is that it's just a It, there's not a legitimate distinction. It's kind of a, it's a marketing term, you know.
Yes, like Harry Potter. I mean, that has adult and young adults reading it and enjoying it.
Exactly. That if you can market a book as YA, great. I think there's two reasons that I don't see my own work as YA. One is the sentences. Like I'm not writing it with the clip or the brevity or the accessibility necessarily. I don't think my sentences are inaccessible, but I really care about sentences in a way that I don't necessarily think fits the YA sensibility. People can right into K Booth. They're angry about that and telling me that.
So you're saying that sometimes a YA novel would have simpler sentences?
Simpler. And then, YA goes really, really dark. So I don't think that my book is darker than YA, but I do think YA tends to stay in the moment of the story. Like, I think there's not a lot of retrospection, there's not a lot of like contemplating what's happening around it in the story. And I think that the story is more contemplative than most YA. And also, it's three points of view, and only one of them is a kid's point of view. So
Oh,
I think,
right, just Lark.
yeah, exactly. So for that reason alone, it's mostly preoccupied with adult concerns. But I would, if anyone wants to cross market this as a YA book, I'm totally good with that because YA books really sell.
Now, at Portland's Up Up Books on July 31st, you'll be giving a workshop on creating complex characters. This book serves as a great example. I wonder what are a few of the suggestions you'll be offering in the
Oh, great.
workshop.
One, I love Up Up Books in Portland. I think it's so wonderful. And Broadway Books, as you've talked about several times now. So there's a couple of approaches that I'm going to take to building complex characters. And it's really about going from the center of the character outward. So one of the exercises I've done in the past that's been really helpful is you start just by describing a character's room, and then you hone in to the nightstand. Like, first we have the whole room, then we have the nightstand, and then like what's the secret thing in the nightstand drawer? Like, where you just burrow in and in and in. Another exercise I really like is putting your character in conversation with someone who they talk past, like they can't get on the same wavelength. So it's dialogue. They're listening to each other and they're trying, but they can't get on the same track. So,
More like real life.
yeah, more like real life. Like, what is revealed of your character when they're trying to communicate and can't? So we'll do exercises like that.
Now, we talked about your friend and a frequent guest on my show. Again, you refer to her in the acknowledgments as the late, great Kai Emmons. Kai took her own life through Oregon's Death with Dignity program. That was January 2023. ALS was breaking da her down physically. I know you miss her very much. What part did Kai play in the writing of Closer? And I wonder if you felt her spirit while finishing up the manuscript.
Absolutely. I feel yes, I miss her so much. And I feel closest to her when I'm writing. I mean, that's when I feel her the most. This was the last book of mine that she read, and she was, one, so enthusiastic about it, and two, had this unflagging belief, more than I did, way more than I did, that it would eventually sell. She and I went through similarly fallow periods in her writing, though hers was shorter than mine. But for years, she just waited and waited and waited. It was between her second and third book. For me, it was between my first and second. Just this long, dry period where, I always knew her work would sell again because she was brilliant. And she did the same for me. So it was both, it was really powerful to finish this book that this was the last book she read of mine. From here on out, it's like post-Kai work. But it was really powerful to finish this book that she believed in and loved. And I totally, it was on her birthday that Regal House got in touch with me and told me that they were going to talk about Closer at their next marketing meeting and decide if they wanted to acquire it. And so it felt to me like, of course, that was the hand of Kai.
She recovered from her dry period pretty well too. A few months before she died,
She
she came out
did.
with two novels, and she's got another posthumous novel I think that will be published I don't know, in the next year or so.
Yeah, I believe it's coming out in August, if I'm correct. August or September. Yeah, she ended up publishing five more novels in her final years.
Yes, amazing.
Really
Yeah,
incredible.
I can't wait to read the posthumous novel because with my last interview with her, she let me read the first part of it, and I'm hanging.
Oh, right. Oh, just you
Yeah.
wait and see. The Bells coming out from Red Hen Press. It's so wonderful.
Now, you recently joined the Eugene Public Library, Miriam. Did you want to talk about the importance of our libraries and the threats they face under the current administration?
Absolutely. Like within days of Trump getting reelected, I reached out to the executive director of Eugene Public Library and said, let me join. Let me be on your board. Let me help protect you. I didn't know what the process was. Months later, they put out a call for volunteer positions for their advisory board, and I got one of those positions. I felt, so much of the advice when Trump got reelected is like focus on the one or two things that are really important to you. And I find that really hard to do because it all feels so perilous and important. But the library in Eugene and so many other towns is this center of public life. It's this accessible place for adults, teens, kids. I spent so much of my life walking through the library aisles, getting books at the library, writing at the library, taking my son to the library. And in Eugene, it's become a hub for LGBTQIA folks. It's been a hub for homeless people. It's like the lowest possible bar of entry to be an accessible, warm, welcoming, safe space for people. And also, it's books. Like the fact that in capitalism, we have this institution where we can have books for free because they're
Yes.
so important is incredible to me. So it feels like libraries are being assailed in a number of different ways. One, with so, the Supreme Court just had this is specific to books in schools and not libraries, but they just ruled that parents can object to LGBTQIA books in schools. Books are being banned at alarming rates everywhere. And also, Trump is defunding things like IMLS, which is the federal agency that governs museum and libraries that I didn't even know existed before Trump. So it feels like libraries are being assailed in all these different ways. And I want to do everything that I can to help protect and strengthen it in our community. Libraries in Salem are imperiled and Grants Pass are imperiled. I just think they are an objective good. There's no downside to libraries. So I felt really strongly that I wanted to get on the front lines and do everything I can to help advocate for ours.
And there's one last project I'd also like to talk about, Miriam, not directly to the new novel, Closer. You recently started this project, 100 Notable Small Press Books, and the goal is to compile a list of the best titles published by small indie U.S. presses between December 2024 and November 2025. Can you talk about the project and why you're doing it?
Yes, this has been such a joy. After the New York Times came out with their notable 100 notable books that they do every November, I love that list. I'm often reading books off that list. I like to check which books I've already read against the books that they've noted. And it's this huge, it's a huge prestige. It's a huge honor to end up on the New York Times notable list. And I noticed last year that 85 of the 100 books on their notable list were from Big Five presses, and that most of the 15 from smaller presses or independent presses were, in fact, they were independent, but they weren't small. They were big, well-funded independent presses. And I had some wine and I was on Blue Sky and I said, hey, if I were going to come up with 100 notable small press books, who would be on board to review? And The response was so overwhelming. I
Wow.
had 70 plus people saying, I'd want to do that. I'd want to read small press books. I'd want to. And I was stunned and overwhelmed and naive about the amount of work it would take. So I quickly set up a way for folks to pick genres, get into groups, and I now have 50 plus reviewers reviewing small press books. We put together a directory of 400 plus small presses in the United States. We said 50-ish books a year, US published, and they can't be an imprint of a big five. Those were the only criteria, but we wanted to do it across genres. So we've got have folks reading fiction, nonfiction, poetry, romance, horror, sci-fi, and then they're writing capsule reviews. And at the end of the year, we are going to pick, there's going to be a selection committee that picks the 100 notable that are, it's going to go up on LitHub in November. And it's been so good. It's been so good for me to get more familiar with small presses, for me to jump in there, read. I'm sort of picking and choosing as I go and reading and filling in and mostly overseeing it. But it's been incredible getting these reviews from folks, seeing all these readers like hard at work reading all these small press books and then sending reviews of them. It's books that don't get the same attention that, like, where we started talking about Big Five. Big Five has the marketing juggernaut to get the word out on books, and these small presses don't.
Well, Miriam, thanks so much for talking with us today. Next stop, the Midwest.
Yes, thank you so much, Ken. Such a pleasure as always.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Miriam Gershow, author of the new novel Closer from Regal House Publishing. Miriam will be heading out soon for a book tour through the Midwest, but she'll be back in Portland on Thursday, July 31st, at Up Up Books. You can find out more about Miriam's work and all her events online at Miriam Gershow, that's Gershow spelled GERSHOW.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, July 24th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.